Marshall, if you want to start us off here then.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Connolly, and Judge Kirk. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are about to start our third case on our oral calendar this morning, which is A21-0787, State of Minnesota versus Darwin Eldridge Anderson Appellant. State is the respondent. We are conducting this oral argument by Zoom. An audio recording will be posted on our website later as normal. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. I ask that you please state the name and the party you represent at the start of your principal arguments. And then counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you're ready to begin, counsel for appellant, you can start.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Nelson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Darwin Eldridge Anderson. Today, I would like to focus this court's attention on the second issue raised in appellant's brief, which is that the district court abused its discretion in denying Anderson's timely pre-sentence motion to withdraw his guilty plea. When a criminal defendant moves to withdraw their plea prior to sentencing, this court analyzes that motion under the fair and just standard and gives due consideration to two factors. The first factor are the reasons the defendant sets forth in support of his motion, and the second factor is any prejudice granting the motion would cause the state by reason of actions taken in reliance on the plea. Under this standard, both the defendant and the state have a burden. Anderson's argument here today is that he carried his burden and the state failed to carry theirs. I'll start by addressing Mr. Anderson's burden. Unlike the higher manifest injustice standard, the fair and just standard allows a broad consideration, considering not only Mr. Anderson's statements at the guilty plea and the sentencing hearing, but also the overall context surrounding his plea. And if there's one thing I can contribute to my brief through this argument, it would be to paint a clearer picture of this overall context under which Mr. Anderson's plea was entered. In fall of 2019, Mr. Anderson was charged with second-degree murder. In January of 2020, he was indicted with first-degree murder and first-degree murder drive-by shooting. For the first month after he was indicted, he didn't have an assigned attorney. The second month after he was indicted, he didn't receive discovery. When discovery was finally released to Mr. Anderson, it was released under a prosecutor's certificate, meaning that Mr. Anderson couldn't physically possess the materials. He had to review these materials through his attorney. In most cases, that arrangement works out just fine. The public defender or the attorney can work with the client to review those materials. But in this case, in March of 2020, the COVID pandemic hit Minnesota. Courts didn't know how to respond to this. Jails didn't know how to respond to this. And the result for Mr. Anderson is that he wasn't able to meet with his attorney and he wasn't able to review discovery.
But counsel, at the plea hearing, he was given the opportunity to raise those kind of issues. And he basically testified under oath that he was satisfied with the representation he had received. How does that jive with what you've just said?
Yes, Your Honor. At the plea hearing, Mr. Anderson did make those statements. He testified that he had time to meet with his attorney. He testified that he was even satisfied with his attorney's performance. But under the fair and just standard...
Was he lying then, counsel?
Mr. Anderson did state at the sentencing hearing, essentially the sentencing motion withdrawal hearing, that he did lie in his plea hearing.
So he admitted he committed perjury when he testified under oath at the plea hearing.
Mr. Anderson's statements at the withdrawal hearing were that he lied in the plea hearing.
And we're supposed to rely on a person who's admitted perjury to buy your argument here?
No, Your Honor. I don't think this court just has to look at Mr. Anderson's statements. If this court was looking at the manifest injustice standard, that really would be the main consideration here. What did he say in the plea hearing? And did those statements establish the offense? But under the fair and just standard, this court can both look at the context. This court can look at the disagreements he had with his attorney. This court can look at the equivocal and hedged nature of his guilty plea itself. So there's a number of factors that this court can look at. And the one thing I'd remind this court is that the fair and just standard is intended to be a less demanding standard than the manifest injustice standard. Now, going back to my mention of the plea being hedged, equivocal, and reluctant, what I mean by that is During the plea hearing, Mr. Anderson did testify to what Judge Kirk said. He testified he had time to meet with his attorney. He even testified that he was satisfied with the performance. But when it came to addressing the attempted second-degree murder conviction, Mr. Anderson didn't understand what he was pleading guilty to.
Well, you know, Mr. Nelson, and I, you know, I'll be candid. I'm not sure I understand transferred intent. So, you know, I can sympathize with your client's, issues. But at the end of the day, my impression of even under the fair and just standard is he didn't sort of think his lawyer was doing a good job for a variety of different reasons. And I guess I'm not so sure that, you know, that what he's complaining about, you know, gets him to the fair and just standard for sort of ineffective assistance of counsel. So why do you think it does when I don't?
Your Honor, I would agree with respondent in this case that Mr. Anderson has not established a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. If he had, plea withdrawal would be mandatory here under the manifest injustice standard. Instead, his complaints about his attorney, his internal feelings that his attorney, in his words, wouldn't have his back when it came to game day, those are things that can be considered under this lower standard in conjunction with the overall context, in conjunction with the inability to review discovery up until September, in conjunction with the fact that during the plea hearing, it took the prosecutor and the judge to convince Mr. Anderson what he was pleading guilty to. During the plea hearing, the prosecutor would ask Mr. Anderson questions, and I don't want to misstate the record, so let me pull up the transcript here. For example, the prosecutor asked, "And you agree when you repeatedly shot at DL that by shooting into the car, you were also attempting to murder JL?" Mr. Anderson says no. The prosecutor then goes through a detailed analysis of how transferred intent works and then re-asks the question. "So you agree that under that concept, you were also intending to kill JL?" And Anderson responds, "Not intention to kill, but unintentional, yes." And so just the mere fact that Mr. Anderson didn't understand this crime that he was pleading guilty to, the fact that he couldn't wrap his mind around how shooting at a person in a car and hitting somebody he doesn't know is there amounts to attempted second-degree murder, that is a fair and just reason to allow Mr. Anderson to withdraw his plea. But I understand what we are arguing.
But even under that theory, I mean, the Supreme Court, I think, disagrees with your position. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Nelson, in terms of transferred intent and what you have to show and when it can be used?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Cruz Ramirez has applied transferred intent broadly, I would argue incorrectly, but given that the Supreme Court is above,
we're just a stop on the way upstairs then.
On that first issue, for the most part, Your Honor, I am trying to give this court a way to distinguish that on the facts, but that's a pretty narrow alley for distinguishing.
And the factual distinction that you were making is that this would be the first case where it was the presence of another party was unknown to the defendant. Is that the distinction?
Yes, Your Honor. In the cases cited both in my brief and in respondent's brief, cases like Cruz Ramirez, Ford, Glass, or even the assault cases, I don't recall the exact name of those cases. It's usually somebody unleashing their dog on a group of people or somebody firing at a group of people. In the unpublished case, Glass, that said it in respondent's brief, a car rolls up on a group of 20 or 30 people and starts firing. And the reason for that distinction is some of the cases, like in Ohio, have upheld the theory of transferred intent based on this idea of deterring people from shooting at groups, or because the group that they shot at were all readily identifiable. I would still argue that's a misapplication of transferred intent. I don't think transferred intent can apply to attempted murder, but obviously that's an issue for the Supreme Court. Under this fair and just standard, we are arguing an abuse of discretion here. And the specific abuse of discretion is that the district court found that there were reasons supporting plea withdrawal and reasons or prejudicial reasons. The court's specific wording was, "I do find when I look at the stated reason by the defense, those are outweighed by the state's counterpoints." So the specific abuse of discretion that I'm arguing here is that there is no prejudice. There was nothing to counterweigh the reasons Mr. Anderson gave. And respondent offers three potential prejudices here. The first is that they no longer have a prosecution witness. The second is that witness memories fade. And the third is that the court experienced a backlog and it would take a long time to get Mr. Anderson's case through the system. My argument is that only that first reason cited by a respondent is worth considering in this case. That's the witness not being available for trial. And on that issue, I think it's really important to look closely at what the state actually established at the plea withdrawal hearing. What the state established is that a key witness had been arrested in Florida and extradited to Minnesota. The prosecution then says, presumably this witness has returned to Florida, and this would be a substantial prejudice to our case. The problem with this prejudice is the state didn't do the legwork to actually establish a prejudice. The language of extraditing suggests that this person committed a crime in Minnesota and was then returned to Minnesota to face those charges. So the prosecution never established that this witness wasn't still in Minnesota. The prosecution also didn't establish that they wouldn't be able to find this witness. And while I would concede if the prosecution has to go back to Florida and transport a witness, that is some level of prejudice. Maybe it's financial prejudice, but what's required is not prejudice. It's undue prejudice. That's from Wolkowitz. And in this case, the mere fact they may have to go pick up a witness from Florida is not undue prejudice. Unless this court has any further questions, I would concede my time.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Nelson, and counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. There's two issues in this case, and I intend to address both of them today, but it's important to keep them separate. The first issue is the sufficiency of the factual basis for appellant's plea to attempted second-degree murder. This issue either entitles him to plea withdrawal on that count, if he's right, but if he's wrong, it does not apply to the fair and just standard here. And that's because appellant was quite clear at the end of the day in his plea hearing that he understood what he was pleading guilty to. This was not ultimately an equivocal plea. He said that he is pleading guilty because he is guilty. And under questioning by the attorneys and the judge, he ultimately said that he fully understood and had enough time to talk to his attorney about the law, and he's guilty based on the actions he took. That's around pages 26 to 27 of the plea transcript. So at the end of the day, he said, and this is pages 20 to 25, he's pleading guilty because he is guilty. His attorney did a good job. He understands the law. So this first issue doesn't go to the fair and just standard. And as counsel has essentially conceded, this is a loser issue under Cruz-Ramirez. I mean, maybe the Supreme Court will change the law on this, but as the law currently stands, transfer intent applies to attempt, period. No exceptions. Appellant is asking his court to change the law by making an exception, but that's like arguing that Miranda doesn't apply to law professors. And no one's ever argued that before, so it's a new issue. There's a broad rule here. Miranda applies when you're in custody, and transfer intent applies to attempt. So that issue doesn't really go anywhere. That just leaves us with the issue that counsel's focused on today, the fair and just issue. And it's important to note here that you do not need to reach the prejudice issue. In the Raleigh case that appellant cites in his reply brief, the Supreme Court upheld denial of plea withdrawal under the fair and just standard, even though it found no prejudice. If there's no fair and just reason, and if the judge didn't abuse her discretion in finding no fair and just reason, then you don't need to reach prejudice. And here you would have to say to Judge Nelson, you clearly abused your discretion by not believing appellant when he said, I lied under oath at the plea hearing. Because at the plea hearing, he said his attorney did a good job. He'd had enough time to talk to him. He understood the law. And this wasn't a plea on the day of trial. There's no reason he couldn't have said, I'd like more time to talk to my attorney about this. We need more time to prepare. I need more time to look at discovery, et cetera. But he didn't say any of those things. He said, I'm pleading guilty because I am guilty. My attorney did a good job. His attorney talked about how much time he'd spent with his client talking about this plea. So everything that's said under oath at the plea hearing clearly supports the plea.
Was there a cutoff date for the appellant to accept the plea agreement?
I don't think that's on the record, Your Honor. I think they just went in and said, we've talked about it and we've reached this deal and here's what it is. I'm not aware of anything in the transcript that suggests that he was under some sort of pressure to take this deal or it was going to go away. Because again, he had made a speedy trial demand, but he certainly could have withdrawn that. And I'm not aware of anywhere in the transcript that says, here's our date certain for trial. You got to be ready by then. And you have to resolve other things before that. I'm sure counsel will correct me if I'm wrong about that. But appellant wasn't hesitant at this plea hearing, and for good reason. He was getting a significantly good deal here, as is noted on the record, because the state was not pursuing then first degree murder charges against him. And he was getting concurrent sentences for murdering one person and shooting another. So there is no fair and just reason here. And the case law talks about it being the rare case where a judge would abuse her discretion by denying plea withdrawal, even under the fair and just standard. And that just leaves the issue then of remedy, which I do want to talk about briefly, because even if it somehow would have been fair and just to allow him to withdraw his second degree attempted murder plea because of confusion about the law or because of some other reason based on the transferred intent, that does not entitle him to withdraw his plea to the first account, to the actual second degree murder. The cases that appellant cites talk about basically a party not being allowed to have their cake and eat it too. I handled the Monomini appeal, and Monomini says, and this is quoting from a Supreme Court case, a plea agreement is in many ways analogous to a contract whose terms will not be enforced to benefit a breaching party. Well, the breaching party here is appellant. He's trying to get out of one of his two pleas, but that does not entitle him to get out of the other one when he's still getting all the benefit that he bargained for, the dismissal of the first degree murder charge. So even if this court found that there was some basis for withdrawal on the attempt account, it doesn't apply to the other count, the actual second degree murder count, where he said he described what he did, which was clearly second degree murder, if not first degree murder.
So, Mr. Raggetts, are you suggesting that if an agreement where some charges were dismissed, that if we were to decide that there was a problem and reverse, and it would be there would be a new trial only then on this charge, the attempt?
Yes. What I'm saying is, I mean,
the other ones remain dismissed. The more serious charge remains dismissed.
Unless the state moved to withdraw from the plea, because the state is the aggrieved party here, where appellant is trying to back out of part of what he agreed to. But under the language I just read from Monomini, just because one person is trying to get out of part of their part of the bargain doesn't mean they get to get rid of everything when they're still retaining the bargain that the state gave up. And the state is not asking here to withdraw from the plea entirely, which it certainly could given appellant's breach. So that's my point on the remedy issue, which this court doesn't need to reach because it would be fairly extraordinary to find this is the rare case where Judge Nelson abused her discretion by not believing appellant when he said he lied under oath at the plea hearing. And unless this court has additional questions on either of these issues, I will simply ask that you affirm Judge Nelson.
Appears not. So thank you, Mr. Raggetts. Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. On rebuttal, there's just 2 points that I would like to address. The first is respondent's citation of Raleigh here. So respondent cites Raleigh for the proposition that this court doesn't need to reach prejudice if there are no fair and just reasons. In Raleigh, the court found that there was no prejudice, but also found that there were not fair and just reasons, and for that reason affirmed. I would argue that the district court's findings at the plea withdrawal hearing do suggest that there were fair and just reasons, but those fair and just reasons were counterweighed out by the state's prejudice. And so I am implying this, not expressed from the district court's language, but I think there is the implication there that the court found some reasons and outweighed those with prejudice. And so if this court determines that respondent did not show prejudice in this case, I would ask this court to find that the district court abused its discretion. Essentially, a fair and just reason can't be outweighed by nothing. And that's where our purported abuse of discretion comes from. The second issue I'd like to briefly address is the remedy in this case. I'm a little bit confused on how to address the remedy, given that respondent's brief argues just withdrawing the attempt plea would be gamesmanship. But in argument today, he's arguing that withdrawing both pleas would be gamesmanship. So I'm not sure essentially what respondent's position is on that, but I would argue in this case, there's a plea deal. Anderson moves before sentencing to withdraw from that plea deal on both counts. If this court finds that either the attempted or the completed second-degree murder charge should be withdrawn, then Mr. Anderson should be allowed to withdraw from the full deal and pursue his trial rights on those charges. Unless this court has any further questions.
But counsel, if we found, as the state asks, that if he's able to withdraw, it's only as to the attempted murder in the second degree, wouldn't that go back then for trial? And if the state chose to try him on that, it's a different victim altogether, would they be limited by their concurrent sentence, or would they be able to ask for a consecutive sentence?
Your Honor, in that case, if the state was just going to withdraw from this attempted and just pursue only that charge of trial, I would argue that wouldn't be appropriate here. But if that is what happens, I would argue the state would be limited by a concurrent.
So you kind of want to eat your cake and eat it too, then? That's what you're telling me?
Your Honor, I'm just asking for Mr. Anderson to be allowed to withdraw his pleas as he asked the district court to do so in 2021. Seeing that there's no further questions, I would just ask this court to reverse Mr. Anderson's convictions and allow him to withdraw both of his guilty pleas and pursue a trial. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for your arguments and for your briefing. Very helpful. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. And that concludes our oral calendar. We will stand in recess for our consideration of our non-oral cases. Thank you.